You are listening to Lighthearted, the official podcast of the United States Lighthouse Society. My name is Jeremy Dontremont. Welcome. Today is March 17th, 2024, and this is episode 269 of Lighthearted. My co-host today is Michelle Jewell Shaw, Chair of Friends of Portsmouth Harbor Lighthouses. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, Jeremy, and hello to all of our listeners out there.
And happy St. Patrick's Day.
Happy St. Patrick's Day to you and all of our listeners.
Yeah. You know, I'm part Irish, and one of my grandfathers was Irish, but I'm 100% Irish on St. Patrick's Day.
Isn't everyone?
Of course, yeah. So in a few minutes, we will listen to a conversation with Buzz Herr, who is the president and co-founder of the Michigan Lighthouse Alliance. So Michelle, thank you for co-hosting well over 100 times since we started this podcast back almost 5 years ago in the summer of 2019. Hard to believe, isn't it?
It is. I can't believe it's been that many.
We are closing in on 300 episodes, and you and Cindy have been the main co-hosts, and both of you have done well over 100 episodes.
Time flies when you're having fun.
And I think a lot of listeners know you're a teacher in real life. So,
yes.
Yeah. How's the school year been going?
It's been an interesting school year, to say the least. Teacher shortages are a real thing, especially in my field of special education, but I've learned that I can adapt to lots of different situations and circumstances. And I've learned a lot of new things this year. So I guess there are some good things. So,
yeah, well, that's a good attitude. I know it's tough. And I know that's happening nationwide, teacher shortages and so forth.
But at the end of the day, it's my students that matter. So that's what I'm there for. That's my why.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. And your students are lucky to have you with that attitude. So before we get to today's interview, I want to mention an event that's happening in New Jersey very soon.
Yes. The New Jersey Lighthouse Society holds meetings 4 times each year. The meetings often include visits to lighthouses and other landmarks, guest speakers, and time for sharing with other lighthouse enthusiasts. One of these meetings is coming up next weekend, March 23rd, in Edison, New Jersey. You can get all the details on the New Jersey Lighthouse Society website at njlhs.org. There's also information about the Lighthouse Challenge of New Jersey, which takes place in October.
Yeah, the New Jersey Lighthouse Society is a great group. They've been around quite a while. I'm planning a trip down that way in May. Really looking forward to it. I'm going to drive down the New Jersey coast, down and through Delaware and into a lot of Maryland. Have you been down that way? Have you seen the New Jersey lighthouses, Michelle?
I haven't seen any of the New Jersey lighthouses. And, you know, we thought about it. I thought about it a couple of times. My oldest son went to college down in Frederick, Maryland. So hitting the coast of Maryland and New Jersey, those places were quite off the path of where we were going. So
yeah. We
were always kind of in a hurry to get there, get back and things like that. So.
Well, maybe one of these years you can do that trip. I'm looking forward to it because it's filling in a big gap in my lighthouse experience. I've seen a lot of the lighthouses around New York and the northern part of New Jersey, but then there's a big gap between there and Virginia for me. So
yeah, I'm
gonna fill a lot of that in. So it's going to be great. Let's get to today's interview. Please help me out, Michelle.
Sure, Jeremy. The Michigan Lighthouse Alliance was founded in 2003. It's comprised of more than 50 preservation groups and lighthouse stakeholders from around the state of Michigan. The purpose of the alliance is to advocate for the preservation of the historic aids to navigation on the Great Lakes.
The Michigan Lighthouse Alliance, or MLA, holds a conference every 2 years, and this year's will be April 21st to 23rd in Port Huron, Michigan. Our guest today, Buzz Herr, is the president and co-founder of the Michigan Lighthouse Alliance.
Buzz is also the founder and chair for the Harbor Beach Lighthouse Preservation Society, which has worked to preserve an 1885 lighthouse on the shore of Lake Huron. In 2015, Buzz received the Richard L. Mole Award for Excellence in Volunteerism from the Great Lakes Lighthouse Keepers Association.
It was a real pleasure speaking with Buzz recently. We discussed the MLA, his efforts with Harbor Beach Lighthouse, and also his efforts on behalf of Lake Champlain in Vermont. Let's listen to our conversation now. I'm speaking today with Buzz Herr, who is the president and co-founder of the Michigan Lighthouse Alliance, among other roles. Thank you so much for being with me today, Buzz.
Glad to be here.
I really appreciate it.
We can talk about lighthouses. I'm happy.
Yeah, me too. I couldn't agree more. get me started. I'm sure you're the same way. But my first question for you relates to what you just said. How did you get so interested in lighthouses in the first place?
My family has maintained a summer residence inside the harbor of Harbor Beach, Michigan. And we would go up there in those days for a month at a time, six kids and my poor mother, and she had to take care of us while Dad went back to work in St. Louis and then back up again. He had to jump back and forth. So, and out in front of us is at that time still was the world's largest man-made harbor, which is a whole other amazing story. And of course it has a lighthouse marking the northern breakwall edge as shipping came in and out of the gap. And mm-hmm. The light was on every night. We were in our bedrooms upstairs and it would flash through the windows. And it was just something sort of like a pulse at night that you just lived with for a long time. And we rarely got a chance to go out and see it, but as time went on and we got older and then we got boats and we got access that, we actually started to go out there and jump off the wall and all that sort of stuff. And that's the first part of my answer. But specifically what changed after all that, everything we had in our house had lighthouses on it and everything. So it was a constant reminder. But what happened is one summer, my best buddy, we were in a grouping of cottages along the shore, and I went out there to do our usual thing, hang out on the breakwall, look at the lighthouse and have a beer. And when we got out there, I couldn't believe it. The Coast Guard had, it's a white exterior, the main tower, but they had spray painted the entire thing white, including the windows, including the glass in the windows. Everything was just spray painted. And that, I'm about to do a webinar for our upcoming conference in Port Huron, leading up to it. And the theme of it is this could not stand. And we looked at it and we said, we got to do something about this. So our interest in the lighthouse went from just having a place to go out and, hang out and look at and all that sort of stuff to, wait a minute, what's going on here? Is this thing in jeopardy? And that was about the time when the Coast Guard was going around and realizing with GPS that it wasn't necessary anymore to have the large shipping. What they didn't realize was the anger of all the smaller boats, the fishing boats and all that sort of stuff. So you know that whole story well. Many of the people watching this probably realize that because they're probably lighthouse aficionados. But that was when the whole thing turned to the private efforts to restore lighthouses. And we were one of them.
Yeah, I want to talk more about Harbor Beach Lighthouse before we get to the Michigan Lighthouse Alliance and the conference sure. that's coming up and everything. From what I've read, what you were just saying, that goes back to about 1982, actually the formation of a official preservation group. Is that about right?
That is right.
You started, is that correct?
Me and my friend Dixon, yes. We started it. And at that time, let me just set the stage a little bit. So the group of cottages we're in is a resort, and there's the town, the city of Harbor Beach, which has been around since those days. I mean, it was a port of refuge and shipping and all sorts of crops and everything moved in and out of there. So we were down on vacation all the time. We didn't really know what was going on uptown or any of that sort of stuff. So we didn't really know anybody other than babysitters that would be hired or people who worked in the kitchen of we had Central Clubhouse for meals, which is a great luxury, still is actually. And he and I were out there again enjoying a beer, and these two guys came out in a boat. And they got out and climbed up the ladder, and we said, hey, how you doing? And everything. It turned out one was the principal of the local school, and the other one was the shop teacher, industrial arts, they call it now. So they got out, and we started walking around, and by that time, we'd figured out how to get a key from the Coast Guard so we could go up in the top and look out over the Great Lake, over Lake Huron. So we took them inside, and the inside of the lighthouse was in worse shape than the exterior. It was just had paint peels hanging off the ceiling, and it was just a mess. I mean, the whole thing was a total mess. So they were, they'd grown up there and they'd seen it. And so it was the first instance of us really relating to the local community was these two guys. And it's really important to say that because they were the ones responsible for recruiting all the local people to come in and get the lighthouse. At that time, the lighthouse and the harbor had been the main focus of people on shore for decades, almost 100 years. But what the transformation happened in that people on shore who didn't really pay any attention to the lighthouse started to realize that this was an icon of their community. And then these two guys started, particularly the principal, started to dig into the history because they'd never paid any attention to it before. So it was really sort of a remarkable melding of the people who came up there just to goof off for a month or two, and the people who lived there and worked there and, you know, had a vested family interest in the community for years. And those sort of conjoined. And I can never tell any of these stories without saying that the local community really got galvanized when we started to learn what was really going on. And they realized, just like we did that day we were sitting on the breakwall looking at, that we can't let it fall apart. If it goes, it's something that everybody took for granted, and we just didn't want to see that happen.
Just for people listening who might not be familiar with Harbor Beach Lighthouse, could you describe the tower? It's a cast iron tower, right?
Conical rings stacked on top of each other, with a lantern room at the top, with a gallery deck right below that, which is a great place to sit at night and watch the stars and everything. So another story I'll tell you later about that. But with Fresnel fourth order lens inside. So that was the lens. And that became something that was at risk because, as you know, and anybody in the lighthouse game knows, that you know, they didn't feel it was important to preserve any of that stuff. They just spray painted everything, and then they realized if they didn't take the lens, somebody may shoot it out with a rifle or something like that. So that was another big moment. We were out there one day, and the Coast Guard, Jim, forgetting Jim's name, the guy who's been a great lampist for years and one of our great resources.
Jim Woodward.
Woodward, Jimmy Woodward.
Woody Woodward.
Woody. Yeah. We got to call him by his right name, Woody. But he showed up one time. They'd already stripped the fog signal building off the side. And we were like, well, where the heck did that go? That happened, you know. And then he said, I've got to go up there. And they took the lens apart, took it down piece by piece in crated, you know, boxes. And then off they went in his vessels, and they ended up, you know, in storage, which we were able to reverse. Years later, we finally got it back, and it's now in the museum on shore. You know, it was sort of shocking. We watched this stage after stage of wiping away the main icon of maritime history that connected Harbor Beach.
Yeah, well, I'm glad that lens was saved, and I'm glad the lighthouse was saved. So over the years, would you say, has the lighthouse been really completely restored, would you say?
Yeah, it's not only completely restored, but we have tours every Saturday. We have a nice big a pontoon boat with a captain, licensed captain, that takes people out from shore in the marina. They all come there, park and everything. So every boat sold out all summer long. It is it's really remarkable. And, you know, it's $20 for a ticket. It's, you know, we don't do anything to make money other than all the fundraising we've done over the years. But yeah, we have, you know, there's it's 8 to 10 people on every boat going out there and coming back. And the next group comes out, and people are just fascinated. It is just remarkable how, especially offshore lights, because of they're out there and nobody's ever really been able to go see it firsthand and everything, or never mind go up in it and, you know, look out over Lake Huron and everything. But it is a huge emotional draw. People, when we do those tours, we have people, you know, that we recruit to be docents, and they explain everything about the history, and we rebuilt the fog signal building, and now the interior of that is carpeted on the walls with every old photograph that Skip Kadar, who's our high school principal, has been able to collect over the years. So it's really a museum out on a breakwall at the end of the breakwall in the harbor. And people are fascinated. Now with camera phones, people go around just, you know, taking pictures of everything, because before those showed up, you know, nobody would really go to the trouble to think about doing that. But they're able to take that back at home and then tell everybody where they went and what it looks like and everything. And that starts more people coming. So it's really been fun to see how that's developed over the years. But I want to get back to your other question. So that's what we've done to make it kind of a tourist attraction. But it's really remarkable that we realized, as we kept replacing windows, building the fog signal building, Doing all that work that we, because of our industrial arts teacher, recruited all of his carpenter buddies, all of his people that he knew in the trades around the area. And we had these massive work parties on Saturdays, and they'd be out there doing all this stuff. And we'd plan it all winter, and then we'd go out. Lou Schillinger is a good buddy of mine up at, Port Austin. It's the same story just about everywhere, where you have to get a bunch of people because it's too expensive to pay anybody to do all this kind of restoration work. And we just got the group out there, and people were fascinated by the project. And one of the things I realized is we were putting stuff in there, but I wondered how long it would really last. So we sat down, and one of our planning meetings, we decided every single thing we do to that was going to have a 50-year life. Actually, it was a 100-year life, but 50 warranted. We tried to do what best we could up to 100, but it was always recognized that we bought something, we'd look it over, we can't do that because that's not going to be guaranteed, blah, blah, blah. Who knows whether the companies would still be around. But it was all about making sure anything we added back in was something that was going to last the way it did from 1885 all the way till the time we got there.
You mentioned earlier a museum on shore as well. Is that right?
Yeah, the Grice House. And the Grice House is a house at the entrance to the marina, the Harbor Beach Marina, which is where everybody has to come in to get parked and then go out on the pontoon boat. So they can do that either on the way in or on the way out. And the original Fresnel lens, it's a good thing you mentioned this, the original Fresnel lens, which we found and we recaptured, we have on display in a lantern room mock-up inside the Grice House. And fortunately, that was largely an agricultural museum because after the big days of shipping got over with and everybody turned their faces towards ag land and crops. And now the thumb, as you probably know, if you've been there, is just a gigantic corn growing area and all that sort of stuff. Once that happened, people didn't really know much about what was going on in the background. So that was largely a museum that had threshers and all that sort of stuff. But when we put the lens in there, it was a big added attraction. And that, I don't know if it saved the Grice House, but it really helps because they get some cash flow out of that.
That's great. Before we move on to another subject, you got to tell me the story you referred to a while ago about looking at the stars from the gallery of the lighthouse. Tell me that story.
Oh boy, I'm going to reveal my secrets here. Just one thing, and it's a big thing. We were able to not only move the lens, the original lens, and reconstruct it in the Grice House after taking it back from the Coast Guard, but we then installed a replica lens in the top that's exact replica.
Oh, that's fantastic. Made by Dan Spinella, I would guess.
And what a great guy. I mean, the people I have met along the way, this interview will never do them all justice, but that guy and his buddies, they built it all in Florida. I actually go down and play hockey tournaments in Florida, and so I got a chance to go watch him as he put that together year after year. And then he brought it all up, and he's still doing this. I don't know if you know that, but he's doing it all the time. And he's a Disney guy. He was
Yes.
doing, yeah, so you know all that. So
Yeah,
anyway.
well, our listeners might not know. Yeah, he's special. He's a works on robotics, or what's the proper word, animatronics or whatever for Disney. Yeah.
Brilliant guy. His garage, he builds them in his garage. It's hilarious when you go there. You expect to see this big workshop and everything. Nope, he's got that all figured out. And so anyway, that's what's up in the top. So I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I always have to give Dan credit. And the whole move of putting those lenses in is a big part of MLA because we showed all of our members, this is what you want to do if you want to have the actual Fresnel lens and not those little silly blinkers that we all had to put up with for years that, when the lenses were taken out. Thank you. I want to give Dan
I'm
credit.
so glad you mentioned that. I'm really, really happy you mentioned that. I've interviewed Dan on this podcast. He's a great guy. And his company is called Artworks Florida,
Artworks
for
Florida.
people who might not know. You might want to look up his website.
Oh, do that. If you like lenses, it's unbelievable what he does and where he's come from starting like that.
Oh, yeah. If anybody's seen the movie The Lighthouse a few years ago, he made the replica third order lens that was used in that movie, which you would never dream was not an actual Fresnel lens.
Absolutely.
Okay, so I think you were trying to change the subject because you're trying to get away from the story of looking at the stars on the lighthouse.
No, not at all. Because the big thing about the lighthouse, the biggest event we had as this story unfolded was getting keys. And the Coast Guard agreed to give us keys as long as we behaved and all that sort of stuff. And so one of the big things we started to do was to go out instead of sitting on the break wall, but sit on the gallery deck at night and look at, out to the northeast and, at Lake Huron and the stars at night, even though there is some background light coming from the city, the street lights and everything. If you look away from that, it's remarkably dark, and it's a fantastic dark sky viewing point. So one night we're out there, and we're having a beverage and just looking and telling stories of whatever went on that day and everything, and looking up at the sky, and all of a sudden I saw a particularly bright star, which is what I guessed it was. So anyway, I'm looking at it, and I tap Dixon, elbow him, and I say, "Man, what do you think that is up there? Is it a planet? Is it a star?" And it was still, so that's why I figured it was a star. Planets move, and so it was just getting brighter and brighter and brighter. And I just said, "What the heck do you think that is?" We thought maybe it's a satellite. Maybe who knows what the heck it is? Well, as it got brighter, all of a sudden it came almost right over our heads. It was a fighter jet with landing lights on. From Selfridge Air Force Base down in Port Huron. And there were four of them. And he came right at us and then booted it right straight up in the opposite direction. So we saw the tail flames coming out and then went up and did a circle and we looked back up again and there was another coming. So there were four of them and they were bombing the lighthouse. And we'll never forget that. I didn't have, we didn't have iPhone cameras then or anything like that. It would have been great to get a video of that. So I've never been able to recapture that. But it was one of those moments when you're out there and you're thinking back to when it all started, and we never would have had a chance to sit out there and see that if we hadn't done all that work. So anyway, there's my story.
Oh, wow, that is an incredible story. I was getting, as somebody who used to attend UFO conferences years ago, I was getting excited about that. But still, what you actually saw is maybe even more exciting than a UFO, I guess. But it's always special being at a lighthouse at night. I know from experience, wherever you are, to have it, kind of have it to yourself or with a, maybe a friend or two and experience that. It's incredible. Yeah.
Yeah, and just for the record, they were A-10 Warthogs. So that's a once we knew that and that event happened, I got all into A-10 Warthogs, trying to learn more about them and all that sort of stuff. So it's just amazing the things that structure has galvanized in so many people's minds over the years.
I'm sure that's what the lighthouses are for people. They're like you said, they have an emotional draw, and they're often centerpieces of communities as well. So on to the Michigan Lighthouse Alliance, and starting out on that, I have a question that might be hard to answer in a sentence or two, but take as much little as much or
As
as
you've
much time
noticed.
as you want. Yeah, what exactly is the Michigan Lighthouse Alliance?
So it's the 126, 7, 8 lighthouses in Michigan, depending on who you're talking to. We realized that this was not just an isolated instance, that there were these lighthouses all around the Great Lakes, more than almost any country in the world. I mean, it's an amazing story how big that effort was to build all those aids to navigation. Other places were having the same problems we were. And there is strength in numbers. And so what we started to do is, and we did it sort of organically, we started with the group in the thumb. So the lighthouses that, that we drove past on the way up to our cottages in the summer. And we started to make contacts. And Lou Schillinger at Port Austin, we were able to realize they were struggling with the same things we were, that they, all the issues we were having to deal with were the same pretty much everywhere. The only major difference being whether it was onshore or off. Because it was offshore, it's far more problematic. And Lou and Port Austin are going to finish this summer a complete restoration of that over $1 million. And by ICC, that fantastic lighthouse group, construction company group. So that's one of the things we're going to be talking about at the conference coming up in April in Port Huron. And we'll have them as our lead speakers, and they're going to tell the whole story, not only of this one, but other Great Lakes lighthouses they've done. So it made us realize, the more we looked into it, there were 120 plus lighthouses around the Great Lakes, predominantly in Michigan, and so we in Lake Superior. So we decided that we were going to make contact with these people, and so we started doing outreach. And we said, "Are you having problems?" And this problems were the same. And we said, "Well, let's get together and see if we can do something about this." And so we, found out the people in state government that we had to talk to, some of whom we were still in touch with, and we realized this was a problem that was happening all over the country. Actually, is that, right where different places all were having it. So we realized there's strength in numbers. So we got together and we started to have these meetings that turned into conferences. And there we would have these guys come in and explain, what the government's position was. I could, I could go on and on about that. But the other, main problem was fundraising, because this was not a cheap effort. It was a very expensive effort. And the further away you were from large groups of people, the less chance you had, because, and mainly that's where lighthouses were. They either fronted a harbor or else they were in some place so people wouldn't crash into rocks, and it was largely unpopulated. So, trying to fundraise and everything, the myriad problems we have in doing this were really something we had to band together and help each other figure out what are the best ways to do this. Where can we find the money? Where can we find the help? Where can then, once we've restored things, can we publicize them so we can get people to come see them and everything? And it was going to be really difficult to do that on our own, in Harbor Beach. And so that's how we started the Michigan Lighthouse Alliance. And it's been an absolutely terrific, terrific group of people, all with the same interest, all with the same desire to get these structures back in shape, and not just to get them back in shape, but to get them in shape so you could take people out there and show them, and people would understand what the value of these places is. And in doing so, then the fundraising could really start. Then you people, I mean, we get people who show up in tours. We get letters from them, and they say, "How can I help?" And those were the kind of things that you just couldn't generate any other way, other than saying, "You got to see this thing to believe it. And oh, by the way,
Yeah.
if you've got a few shekels, that would help." So fundraising is a whole other story, but we have a central clubhouse for eating meals in our resort. And I started fundraising with my wife selling t-shirts at lunch when people came in and out. And I'm happy to say we have almost $300,000 in an endowment now over the fundraising we've done. And that's after we've done all the work, and it's all done now. All we do is just take people out there and show it to them. So that whole pathway had to be described and explained to people. And the key people in the Michigan, Dick Mole, all those people, they were huge about that, because they were used to raising money. They were used to doing charitable stuff and everything. So when we bring these people in who liked their lighthouse, but they didn't even know where to start, we would have the conferences, would have work breakout sessions and all that sort of stuff. And then these people were available all year long if you ran into a jam and you wanted to have help finding an answer.
Yeah.
So anyway, sorry to go on, but it strength in numbers is key. And it wasn't just about your lighthouse. It was about all of them being, because this whole time frame is the same for everybody. Started in the early 1980s, or somewhere around then. And now a great many of them are completely restored and able to put on tours.
What a great thing. I love the idea of it.
The fact that they're so evocative and have a history in each place. Because the story about the lighthouses in Michigan being built is not just about navigational. It's definitely navigation. But the other thing was, it started after the end of the Civil War, because once the Civil War was over and the shipping lanes became free and open, and it was a big deal, they realized there were always boats crashing. The shore of the Thumb is shipwreck, city. They're just nothing but wrecks all the way up and down. So that spurred interest, and then the lighthouse government lighthouse program started. And then the interesting thing about Harbor Beach is it is that conical tower, and there are a bunch of those all over the place. So they even got to the point where, rather than building something that was particular to that area, they realized it was a lot cheaper to just build those huge iron rings. And those iron rings were actually, forged and produced in Harbor Beach, north of the city. So that, you know, it's actually a very local deal, but using what the Lighthouse Board decided would be a way to mass produce lighthouses and then stick them everywhere, because that's copied all over the Great Lakes.
Over here too. I mean, my local lighthouse, before we started here, I was telling you about Portsmouth Harbor Lighthouse near me here. It's another cast iron lighthouse. It's more closer to being cylindrical than a lighthouse like Harbor Beach, but it's several cast iron cylinders bolted together, and we have a bunch of those lighthouses here in New England. Cast iron, I'm sure a lot of listeners know, became the material of choice getting into the later 1800s, into the early
Well, and
1900s.
of necessity, because it was a very daunting place to have a structure last any length of time. I mean, you know, Lewes got a brick building out on his huge piece that he sits on, big piece of concrete and rocks and whatever else is inside of that. But you know, it had to be built to last, and that meant, you know, it had to be seriously engineered and very well constructed and everything. And the other thing that's interesting about it is you could build it at whatever height you wanted just by adding rings. So that was, you know, again, you can see that they really thought about this and made they were built to last.
Absolutely. So getting back to the Alliance, of course, I'm sure a lot of people know that are familiar with GLICA, as it's usually referred to, the Great Lakes Lighthouse Keepers Association, which is one of the larger lighthouse organizations in the country, I think, as far as membership goes. And going back, you mentioned Dick Mole, I think, was one of the originators of GLICA. So does the Alliance work closely with them
But
on
hand in
projects?
glove, we're there. Well, there is a period of time that has come about that I look at the pictures of the early conferences, and they're literally like 80 or 90 people standing all together. The classic one on our Facebook page. If you go to the Facebook page, that's the header, and you'll see everybody you've ever met in Lighthouse. That was the big time when we were really going at it, when we had our conference in Mackinac, and it just attracted everybody because everybody was into it and they really wanted to get going, and Dick was alive and well and urging us on and all that sort of stuff. So it's something that we never got into a battle with GLICA. It's just that the lighthouses now, there's a critical mass of them that are all done. You know, they just need to be maintained. They need to have access provided to them. And also, those people are not with us anymore. So you've got to start the whole engagement of another generation or two to realize the value in this and what they've got to do. So that's my 50-year life mandate and everything. If you don't leave it in the shape where it's going to be easy to take it over, the whole thing we saw when we went out there could happen all over again.
I concur with everything you just said. Absolutely.
And a lot of it was spurred on, really galvanized, not only by the individual actions, but we realized we were at odds with the state government. We were at odds with the Coast Guard, you know, because they just didn't want to spend any more money. They didn't want to, you know, do all that sort of stuff. So it wasn't just about, say, saving the lighthouses. It was, we had to get the resources to do that, and we had to get permissions to do that and all that sort of stuff. So the more people we had, and generally, it attracted people somewhat of means, I guess I would say, and anybody else who wanted to join. But, you know, Dick Mole would go down to Lansing and rattle people's brains to, you know, hey, you got to get on this because these things are going to go away for good. And it's a tourist thing. You know, that rang big bells. That woke everybody up to that, the necessity to preserve for that reasons and everything. So again, there were so many people from different walks of life that were involved, but generally, they were people who could get stuff done. And there were groups had problems with people, a few people who couldn't get stuff done. So it's had this sort of period where you got to find the people that are going to get the job done, know how to raise money, know how to recruit people, all that sort of stuff. And it's one of the great private undertakings of buildings that I mean, you see that all over the place, but this thing has a particularly emotional tug. It's very evocative.
We'll talk more about the conference, but what are some of the things that sort of concrete accomplishments that the Alliance has done over the years?
Well, providing Dan Spinella with a pathway for lenses has been great because not only is the building evocative, but the flash of light up there is, you know, that's the soul of the lighthouse. And the fact that we were able to work with him hand in glove to find these lighthouses that were interested in doing lenses and everything. And that's been an ongoing story for a number of years now, and a very successful one. So that every one of these initiatives just spurred people to join, spurred specific people who had skills that could make that stuff work. And that's what MLA really did. We would pick those things up and provide contact with the people, and then spread the word and do the conferences so the emotion stayed high. We just realized that we had to do all that stuff because a lot of the people that started on this, not me in particular, although I'm getting there, were older. And we realized that, the leaders, the ones who really jumped in, were going to age out before their structures could be completely rehabbed. And if they didn't, and we didn't help them, show them the way to recruit and raise money and everything like that, the thing could sputter out and die. And so that's, we realized that, just like we sat on the break wall that one day and say, this can't stand. We repeat that every year at the conferences, and we just, we got to keep working on this. We got to save these things.
Yeah. Oh, it's never finished. So the conference this year is at Port Huron, right? And it's at a different place every year. Is that correct? And part two of that question is, how do you decide where it's going to be each year?
Well, we think geographically. We always think critical mass of people who might want to come too. So we don't want to be so far away. We haven't done one in Duluth, for example, or on the North Shore, of Superior, because I don't know how to get there. But Mackinac was easy. I think that was probably a great signal event for us, because as you'll see on that Facebook opening page, that was where everybody knew they had to come, because that was where we were going to have all the right people to talk to and all that sort of stuff. So that sort of led the way. And since then, we've been in different places, and we do it every 2 years, so that we, because it's quite an undertaking, and it's all volunteers. But we were in Holland, which was a great place. And John Gronberg and his crew there have done a fantastic job with their lighthouse restoration, but also have a beautiful marina right there at the entrance into the lake. And so we had great parties. So like any conference, you got to get, make it something that people are going to want to attend. Now, the reason this year for Port Huron is that we had never done anything in that location, and that's a nexus for lighthouse people, Coast Guard, blah blah blah. And it's really, you can tell by the fact that the whole Port Huron situation, with the lighthouse there, with the Huron Lightship, with the museum, Carnegie Museum. I mean, those are all really cool places. And so we figured, and not only that, but you just jump on the bridge and go across, and there's a whole bunch of Canadian people that are just like us. So we're advertising to them. So we want to get as many people together, sort of get back to that Mackinac kind of feel where everybody was all together. So that's what we're looking forward to doing, because not only are those all there, but we're structuring the conference so everybody can go see the lighthouse, the Carnegie, and the Huron Lightship, and then have dinners and events that happen at the same time. So it's like any trade show, you gotta make it something attractive so people will come.
Oh yeah. I was just remembering back, I think it was 2021, you actually invited me to speak at the conference, and I was pretty excited about that, and then COVID happened. So that particular trip didn't happen. So one of these years I've got to make it to the conference. I'd love to. I wish I could go this year, but it's not going to happen this year. But how many people do you generally get at these conferences?
Depends. We saw the numbers dip the last couple of times. Well, not in Holland for sure, but down to 80, I think. We were getting over 100 for a number of years. But again, the people that are working the lighthouse game now are generally smaller in number in each lighthouse, because it's not like we've got all the trade groups and everybody wanting to come in, the guys who did the work and all that stuff. It's mostly the presidents and, the people that are still are now operating it basically as a going enterprise, as opposed to trying to repair it and fix it and everything like that. So now it all has turned towards, how are we going to keep these things going for the next for at least the rest of our lifetimes. But so there's a whole conversation about, okay, how's the handoff happen? How do you get younger people? We have Eastern Michigan University is going to be there with some people, some kids that do projects in lighthouses, and they're going to talk about their projects. And we envision courses in the state colleges and things like that if people want to learn about it. There are all kinds of ideas just because we don't want to get to a point where any of us are sitting on our shoreline and looking at lighthouses that are falling apart again, or we've fallen apart before that happens. I don't know.
Getting younger people involved is always the $64,000 question. How do we do that? How do we attract them? So I'm glad to hear that's one of the concerns that you're dealing with. By younger, of course, I mean anybody under 65, because most of us in the lighthouse preservation world are over that.
Well, we've learned there's actually a demographic kind of rule we follow. Like, you always go for retired teachers or serving teachers for docents because they like to teach, they like to study. We've got a great guy in Harbor Beach now. He will just about wear you out with every fact there is, but and answer every question because he did his homework before he started doing it. We said, well, here's all the stuff we've got, and he studied everything. And now the people just stand there and listen because he sells spellbinding stories and all that sort of stuff. So the teachers are important. Young people and, retired teachers, they can retire on a pension pretty early. So they end up being kind of a good group to go approach. Kids, though, the Eastern Michigan program has been able to find a way to do it. So that's in a curriculum, a structured curriculum. So that might be a good thing to pass on to other people. And just generally getting people out there because, they may go for a tour now, but in another 10 years and they're still living in the area, they say, wow, I want to get in there and help that. I remember when I went out there. I remember when my wife and I went out there, so it has a power, and it might bounce back at some point in the future. That's really another reason to do tours so that people don't ever forget about it.
Where do the people come from who attend the conferences? Are they pretty much from the Great Lakes area to get people outside of the area?
That is the primary audience, but we've had lighthouses from Florida. I think we re I'm not gonna this isn't bragging, but I think we were so well organized so quickly when everybody started real everywhere started to realize this was a problem and needed to be addressed. I think we looked big and strong early. So people from different lighthouses from Canada, for example, would come to our conferences once they heard about it. We just would send a letter and say, if you want to come, you're welcome to come. And it's in a cool place, and there's lighthouses to see. So everybody wanted to see different lighthouses. So that's pretty much what our game plan is to try and get everybody. And we've had as many as 120 or 130 people coming. And at this point, I don't anticipate us going necessarily after big numbers because most of them have a group that are taking care of it. It's just, how do we keep going? How do we raise money? All that sort of stuff.
Oh, networking is super important. Let's talk about this year's conference. What are some of the highlights of this year's conference?
Well, fortunately, it's not me, but I think that this year being able to see the lighthouse, the lightship, and the Carnegie, and have a conference and a conversation. That's a lot in one event. Like, that reminds me of Mackinac because people wanted to go to Mackinac. I mean, it's far away, and a lot of people in Michigan know about it. But if you were a resident of St. Louis, which I was when I was growing up, but it was a summer place, I'd heard about Mackinac, but I'd never gone. So, there's a whole lot of people that may or may not have been there before. So that's why we think Port Huron will be a good attraction. And the people who run the museum there are now on our board, Andrew Kircher primarily, and his partner. And they are fantastic. I mean, they're putting out feelers through different media. They're young. That's really nice. I mean, I work where in a field where I communicate electronically quite a bit, but they're really good at it, and they've already blasted people, and they're going to keep doing it. So I have a feeling with the two-country audience that we have right there, that might be interested if they haven't been to see the Carnegie and everything like that. I think it might draw a whole lot of people, and so we'll see.
What about speakers and presentations? What's happening this year?
Well, we're gonna have the key lighthouse people are going to talk about the history of everything. We're going to talk about how to key things that you need to do to protect your lighthouse. We're going to talk about fundraising. We're going to everything that I've been talking about, they're all going to be topics for speakers to come in and present. A fair number of them internally, because we've got a lot of experience, and we don't want to have somebody come in and talk about building hotels or something. So it's really kind of an it's an inside game. So there's plenty of a wealth of speakers inside that we're tapping to come and present. And it's great to see people who've been successful and been doing what we've been doing for all these years, because that experience is really what people want to come and hear.
Oh, yeah. So you mentioned some of the other activities, museums and things in the area. Is there also anything like music or things like that included?
Yeah, there's an entertainment component that, we always try and do that. So we've had entertainers who come on, and I think we're going to be doing it this year, that sing lighthouse songs. There was a whole layer of as time went by with lighthouses, about who these keepers were and what was their life like, especially if they were offshore, especially if they were in a particularly cold area that had rough winters, and when they had to get off and when they had could go back on, and what did their kids do and everything. So that's a pretty fertile territory, and that's also evocative and interesting, because how many people ever that was their life? It was very, very few in number.
Yeah, and it's a way of life that's pretty much extinct these
Yeah.
days in most of the world. Yeah. So, how do people get more information about the conference and how do they register for the conference?
MichiganLighthouseAlliance.org, and you can go there and you'll see the whole program, and you can register, and you can see the housing options, which, because of where we are, plenty in number. But a key one that is going to be where we're going to be doing a lot of the meals and sit downs and all that sort of stuff, the meetings. So yeah, you just go there, you'll open it up, and you'll see the whole situation laid out, April 21st to 23rd. So we've done them before in May, but for some reason we figured it might be better to get this going a bit earlier. So
Yeah, similar in New England, where most lighthouses are, when they open to the public, it's seasonal and a lot of them open Memorial Day. But it's kind of nice to have events earlier in May or late April before people really get geared up for their busy season. It's kind of a kickoff for the season, I would think, for a lot of people. Yeah.
So we'll be in port here on, and then we'll go 2 years before we do another one. And I don't know, we don't know where that'll be. Each one of our board members is tied to a lighthouse, and so we like to show our lighthouses. One of the things we're going to emphasize is that the Thumb Coastal Tour. So we market it as a, Port Huron, and you go up to the different lighthouses along the shore and end at Port Austin. So there's a whole tour that you can take on M25 and go from bottom to top. So I imagine people, if they're retired or have the time, they may do the conference and then go on and check out other places, and we'll make that available for them too.
So I imagine you have sponsors for the conference. How do people find out about that?
We do have sponsors. A lot of it is internally funded by our groups. So we come up with money, but the construction company ICC, fantastic enterprise, is going to be there, be our lead speaker. I mean, they have so much experience, and for people to come and see the Parla, the Port Austin whole construction story and everything, as told by the people that are actually doing it, is going to be amazing. And because there's so many things to go into restoring a lighthouse, and they've done everything with Parla. I mean, it's got to be, because it's out there in the middle with the raging waves around it. So that'll be, one of the highlights for sure.
ICC, I'm sure a lot of listeners know, used to be International Chimney Corporation. Of course, that's where ICC comes from. I know they just use the ICC name these days, but they go way back in lighthouse preservation and lighthouse moving lighthouses. Of course, several in New England and Cape Hatteras in North Carolina, but just do wonderful work, have been for a long time. So it's great that they're a big part of the conference.
They're a very generous sponsor too. So that's the good thing is, within our community, things have gone on well for everybody, and people don't mind chipping in money to help show off what's going on and everything. And there'll be lots and lots of visuals and Q&A available for people. So it's really kind of getting, you know, getting back in the spirit of it. So you walk out of this conference recharged and feeling like, yeah, we can keep doing this.
I have two final questions for you, and these are for bonus points, okay? So get your number two pencil ready here. First of all, why do you think it's so important to preserve lighthouses?
Well, primarily as aids to navigation, that's always the focal point that we have, that we've got to make sure the lens is properly done. But all that sort of stuff has to happen. Largely, it doesn't involve the ships anymore because they're all flying around and, you know, they could do it in the dark, the fog, the, you know, weather, anything. Because A, they're bigger, so they can withstand any of the storms they're going to run into. And B, they've got all the navigation aids that are all internal now and electronic. So, but especially for people who fish, for people who sail. I mean, you know, the Great Lakes have a parade of boats, private owned boats going up and down the shoreline all the time. So it's very helpful for that. And it's helpful for the community because it draws people in those boats to come into the harbor and tie up and go eat in the restaurant and so on. So and also in that vein, for the community to have a particular icon to identify with, I think it's local pride. It's local understanding of a really interesting history that happened there. It's not just some place alongside a highway. There's that other side of it out there that just story after story and, you know, brings to mind all kinds of things. So I think it's just another level and layer a community can count on to be to have something like that right in front of them.
Final question. I was going to ask you what your favorite thing is about being involved with the Michigan Lighthouse Alliance, but let me broaden that. What has been your favorite thing about your involvement with lighthouse preservation over the years?
You know, when you're in this and you're traveling around in life, you see other lighthouses. It's inevitable. You know, you're always going to be looking for that. Interestingly, I am the chair of the Lake Champlain Basin Program here in Vermont, and I have been in that position for 28 years. And my patron has been Senator Patrick Leahy. And Senator Leahy was a graduate of St. Michael's College here in Burlington, Vermont, of which I'm a graduate. Played hockey there for 4 years, coached the hockey team for 8 years, still go to mass there every Sunday. It's a good Catholic enterprise. And Patrick and I became very good friends about doing the lake work because he got us millions and millions of dollars to try and save Lake Champlain, you know, clean up the pollution and all that sort of stuff. But we have a break wall out in front of Burlington. You're going to see where this is going. And there's a break wall in front of Burlington. Maybe you've been here. You know that.
I have. Oh, yeah. Many times. Yeah.
Yeah. So this was a freshwater maritime place and a lot of history about that going on. And I got into all of it because, of course, in Michigan, I got into all of it. So I had to get a nosy and find out about all of it here. And there were two lighthouses, one at either end of that break wall, and the traffic would go around and then come in, and there were ship. There was you didn't travel by road in Vermont or New York State. You went on the boats that went up and down the lake. So I noticed that the Coast Guard came in and took the towers down and blah blah blah. And I said, well, we can't have that. So I went to Senator Patrick Leahy and I said, we got to put the lighthouses back up, because at the same time, I was also one of the primary movers of putting a lake water history and science museum on the shoreline that is hugely popular and draws people from all over the place, because I also was part of an international lake saving enterprise that allowed me to travel to Japan and Indonesia. I travel all over the world learning about lake water quality issues and all that sort of stuff. So anyway, back here, I started getting sort of courageous. We have a historical side to that, but when the lighthouses disappeared, I said, no, we can't do that. So the senator came up with the money to rebuild those lighthouses out there at a higher level and less surface area to be hit by the waves, because it is pretty rough there. And so we had an event and we said, there are the lighthouses out there. So I'm happy to say that I've got two more lighthouses back in service again. So, and he was great. He just, because I told him the whole story about Michigan. And then he started helping me in Michigan with senators out there. You know, yeah, you got to help this guy. It's amazing if you make the right contacts, how things sort of drop obstacles drop here and there. Things happen.
And that is quite an accomplishment. That's a while ago. We're talking 20-ish years ago.
Yep.
So I'm glad you brought that up. What a great thing to bring back lighthouses that have been lost.
Let me tell you one final story. So the thing that galvanized me to do the Lake Science Center ECHO, it's Ecology, Culture, History, and Opportunity is the acronym for our place there, was I was doing this traveling around the world. I was seeing all these marine environments, freshwater marine environments and everything. And there was commerce in all those places. So lighthouses are not peculiar to Michigan. Of course, they're everywhere. And we had a International Lake Environment Committee is based in Japan, and they are basically the MLA of the freshwater lake movement throughout the world. And they're highly organized, really a cool group. And they have a museum, and it's called the Lake. Their offices are on Lake Biwa, which is just in central Japan. But it's a fantastic place. And that's what got me to do our own science center, $20 million project we raised for that. So with the great help of Senator Leahy again. But while I was there, I was traveling around because I was able, I've traveled to so many lakes all over everywhere. And we had an international lake group of 900 people like MLA, but 900 lakes around the world. We had representatives in all of them. So I was there at the offices, and we had a conference there, and I just did some traveling, took a train up to northern part of the lake because there was an island in the middle of the sort of north big bay that was up there as opposed to the really big part of the lake. And I just wanted to go there because I had a time off, and I took a tour boat out there and then got on the island and went all because I was seeing these falcons circling in the air above, and there was a lighthouse on the top, very top of that. And I went all the way up to the top of it, and I ended up sitting on that promontory and looking south on a beautiful sunny day and realizing, wow, this is sort of the epitome of being a lighthouse person, is that I'm able to come here and experience this. It was real. It's very emotional still. Thinking about fresh water, how important it is, and providing safety for people and everything. So there's a whole other thing that's rolling around in my mind all the time. I hope I didn't bore you with that.
Not in the slightest. First of all, thank you so much, Buzz, for spending this time with me today. It's really fascinating, and I congratulate you on all you've done over the years. I mean, I think back, going back to the 80s, you were kind of on the front line or the forefront of lighthouse preservation at that time. You were one of those people like Dick Mole and others who were right there in some ways at the beginning of the modern preservation movement for lighthouses, I would say. Yeah. And I love the fact that you've made kind of networking, cooperation, and those kinds of things as a central component of what you do. It's so important. Like I said, I'd love to see more of it. And I think the MLA, the Michigan Lighthouse Alliance, could be a model for other states. But anyway, Buzz, it's all fascinating. I hope we can do it again sometime. I hope I can make it out your way, or either to Burlington, Vermont, or over to Lake Michigan. I hope I make one of these conferences, not Lake Michigan, but the Great Lakes, I should say.
Thank you very much for all that praise. It became so automatic to do all these things. And I just happened to run into the right people at the right time.
Good luck with the conference. I'm sure it's going to be great, and I would expect you'll get an excellent turnout for it. Sounds like a perfect place for it. So good luck with everything, and thank you again, Buzz.
It's my sincere pleasure. Thank you, Jeremy.
For more on the Michigan Lighthouse Alliance and their upcoming conference, check out MichiganLighthouseAlliance.org. For more on Harbor Beach Lighthouse, visit HarborBeachLighthouse.org.
I'm sure most of our listeners know that Michigan is the state with the most lighthouses, with around 120 or so, depending on how you count them. Michelle, do you know what state is second?
Would that be New York?
It would be. Very good. You will see different numbers for New York depending on how you define a lighthouse. I've seen anywhere from around 70 up to close to 100, but I would say there's 70-something lighthouses in New York. So do you have any plans to visit any lighthouses this spring or summer, Michelle?
I actually would like to get back up to Owl's Head in Marshall Point at some point this spring or summer. It's been a while since I've been up there, and it's been a while since I visited any of the Massachusetts lighthouses, too. So That's definitely on the list for this summer sometime.
Sure. Yeah. Well, Midcoast, Maine, Al said Marshall Point. They're beautiful lighthouses, and it's just a beautiful area. I love it there.
Yeah.
A reminder to everyone to visit uslhs.org to learn more about all the things the U.S. Lighthouse Society does. If you enjoy this podcast, please consider supporting it with a donation or membership.
Also, if you listen with Apple Podcasts, please rate and review us.
I want to mention that we just started something new called Lighthearted Light. That's Lighthearted Light, L-I-T-E. We will be posting short 10 to 20 minute edited interviews from past shows. I realize that not everyone wants to listen to podcasts that are nearly an hour long, as a lot of these episodes are. So this is a way for people to listen to shorter episodes and still get all the highlights. We just posted, two episodes, two of these short Lighthearted Light episodes in the past couple of weeks, and there will be more. Not posted every week, but they will be posted pretty often, along with these regular episodes every weekend as well. So it's cold and windy today. It's been so windy lately, but we set the clocks forward, right? We sprang ahead a few days ago, and the days are getting longer. And the first official day of spring, I believe, is the 21st in just a few days. So that's going to be nice.
I'm definitely ready for spring.
Me too. Do you have any quotes about spring, Michelle?
I sure do, Jeremy. The columnist Doug Larson once wrote, quote, "Spring is when you feel like whistling, even with a shoe full of slush," end quote.
Yeah, or a shoe full of mud.
Yes.
It's kind of the mud season here in New England. And of course, it's also the time of year when everything is coming back to life. On next week's episode of Lighthearted, we'll be talking with two people who host another Lighthouse podcast called The Lighthouse Lowdown. Until then, to all our regular listeners and our new ones, thanks so much for listening and
keep a good light.
I'm gonna let it shine, let it shine, let it shine.